from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Happy New Year! We have a special program today where we'll revisit some of our favorite conversations with authors from last year.
We'll start with my chat with Dan Wakefield.
Then I'll get to talk with Dan Carpenter.
And we'll wrap it up with James Alexander Tom. Plus, we'll have a very short arts calendar we call
What Do We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Author Dan Wakefield first published Under the Apple Tree in 1982. The book looks at the home front in World War II through the eyes of a 10-year-old boy whose older brother goes off to war and the girlfriend he leaves behind. The boy's duty is to see that she doesn't sit under the apple tree with anyone else. The book was recently re-released in a new edition, and Travis DiNicola spoke with Dan about the book.
Dan, welcome back to Art of the Matter. Always great to have you in the studio.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So, Under the Apple Tree has just been re-released. Congratulations on that. I know it came out originally in 85, and it's great to have the book back in print.
Yeah.
We're gonna have you read from it in a bit and certainly talk about the book, but I want to start by asking you to tell me a bit how this book came to be, because I know there's a story about you sitting on the roof of your house when you were a kid.
Yes, sitting on the roof of my porch at 6129 Winthrop, and I was looking for enemy airplanes through a pair of binoculars. And I was a Boy Scout and a junior air raid warden, and I had memorized the silhouettes of Messerschmitts, Stukas, and Zeros. And I was convinced that Indianapolis would be a prime target of the Germans and the Japanese. And my feeling was that if they could knock out Indianapolis, they would knock out the heart of the country. That mm-hmm. would be the end of morale. So that was my rationale for it.
Do you remember? So this is during World War II. And do you remember where did you have playing cards that had the silhouettes of the fighters on them?
No. It was a book.
It was a book.
And they were quite large silhouettes, and you memorized those and looked for them. And, of course, we never saw one enemy plane over Indianapolis.
Which is a good thing.
Mm-hmm. That was in our imagination. See, I had already, with the Boy Scouts, collected 1,000 pounds of scrap paper and innumerable pots and pans. We were told, I think it was in Life magazine, that if you could collect 700 pots or pans, that would be the equivalent of the wing of a P-39 fighter plane.
Wow.
So that was a great inspiration. And of course, one of the great songs of the times was Don't Sit Under the Apple Tree mm-hmm. with Anyone Else But Me. And that really gave me the idea of the plot of the book, because the idea of the time was just remembering myself on the roof with binoculars looking for enemy airplanes. I thought, my gosh, if you could explain why an otherwise rational kid of 11 or 12 was doing that, you could explain a whole world that existed then.
Yeah.
And but then that left, you can't write a whole book about a kid looking for enemy airplanes that never appear. So I imagine, the song of Under the Apple Tree was Don't Sit Under the Apple Tree with Anyone Else But Me. So the idea was for girlfriends of soldiers who went off to war to not hang out with other guys. Mm-hmm. Of course, there weren't very many other guys to hang out with. But So I thought, well, the boy should have for the story an older brother who goes off to war, and it's the boy's mission to protect or look after or spy on the girlfriend. Mm-hmm. And I don't have any brothers and sisters. And I had a cousin who lived next door who was kind of like an older brother. And he was a tail gunner on a B-17. But in my imagination, in my story, I wanted the older brother to go to the South Pacific and fight in that theater of war. And there was a boy down our block on Winthrop who joined the Marines. So I thought, well, I'll make him like that guy who joins the Marines and might go to the South Pacific. So I was really able to get in the elements of World War II on the home front.
And how it affected everybody.
That's right.
Everyone who was left behind, from kids to girlfriends to parents.
And, of course, there was rationing of food. There was rationing of gasoline. I remember I was very proud that my father was a pharmacist, so he got a B ration card for gas. If you're a doctor, I think you got a C card, but if you're an ordinary citizen, you just got an A card. You could only get very few gallons of gas. But the amazing thing, I think it was the one time in American history when Americans were, for the most part, very united, very clear in their purpose for the issues of this war were very clear cut, unlike the wars we've fought since. And I wanted to just read a part that, to me, summed up what feeling was. And this is through the minds of the boy who's 12 years old. Said, in the crisp, clear days of October, America was beautiful, just like in the song. Artie had never been from sea to shining sea, had never seen the purple mountain majesty, but he knew they were out there, believed in them, and saw every day with his own eyes the beauty of the gentle hills, the creeks and cornfields, the solid old white frame houses, and the ancient oaks of town. He believed, in fact, that God had shed his grace on this land, that this grace was tangible, visible, in the arch of rainbows over wet fields, the slant of shed sunlight on the sides of barns. His pride in his country was sustained by the signs of nature and the symbols of men, not only the bright stars and stripes that flew from public buildings and hung from private porches, but the comforting, everyday emblems of home. Bob's Eats, Joe's Premium, Mail Pouch Tobacco. This was what Roy, his brother, and all the other boys were fighting to save, preserve, and protect, along with the people who were lucky enough to live in and of it. And all this was sacred, worthy of any sacrifice, including life itself. For without it, life would be hollow and dumb.
Dan, this book is, it's not actually set in Indianapolis, though it very well could be.
Yes, I had set one novel in Indianapolis called Going All the Way, and that caused me such grief that I decided I would never do that again, so that I wouldn't have people claiming, oh, this, they're this or that character, and this or that happened. So I imagined a town in the Midwest that I just made up in my mind called Burney, Illinois. But it was really based on my experience growing up in Broad Ripple. And at that time, Broad Ripple was a real close-knit neighborhood. It was not yet called a village, which always has kind of perplexed me. I imagine a village peopled with elves, but we were proud of it just as a neighborhood.
So this book, Under the Apple Tree, it's a very, very sweet story. It begins in sort of a very sweet way of this young boy thinking about his brother and sort of, you know, protecting the home front. But it also deals with a lot of issues of how difficult it was for the families and friends of the people who went overseas in World War II, and also all the really difficult problems they had when they came back.
Yes, and I like to say another thing. It was very difficult for Italians, for Germans, especially for Japanese who were American citizens.
Sure.
You know, I didn't know till the 90s that Japanese American citizens were rounded up on the West Coast and sent to internment camps. And everything in the book that I quote from a magazine or newspaper is an actual quote. And I just want to read a very brief thing. Will show how crazy this kind of fear,
sure,
particularly for the Japanese. This was an article in Time magazine, and it said how to tell the Chinese your friend from the Japanese your enemy. It said,
wow,
those who know them best often rely on their facial characteristics to tell them apart. The Chinese expression is likely to be placid, kindly, open. The Japanese more positive, dogmatic, arrogant. Most Chinese avoid horn-rimmed spectacles. Japanese are nervous in conversation, laugh loudly at the wrong time. Japs are likely to be stockier and broader-hipped. Well, this is sort of the hysteria and craziness. And in grade school, we were given a war stamp book in which you saved up your dimes and bought a stamp,
mm-hmm,
and you filled up this book by placing the stamps over the fang-like, blood-dripping faces of Japanese soldiers,
wow,
and it said, slap the Jap right off the map. So it was a very hard time for American, really, citizens who were deprived of their citizenship in many cases and put in these internment camps. And I was very happy to recently learn that people who wanted to get out of the camps and go to the Midwest or East, where there wasn't such a fear of Japanese Americans, one of the places that they were invited to come was Indianapolis, and people from the Disciples of Christ Church, which had had missionaries for many years in Japan, helped this effort. And sort of to my amazement, Indianapolis is one of the places that welcomed them, and a wonderful paper by a scholar here, a Japanese-American woman named Nancy Connor. The end of her paper recounting this says, when the call came, there were people in Indianapolis who were prepared to answer. And I was very proud that in the midst of that hysteria, there were people right here who were willing to help Japanese Americans get jobs and be resettled and treated as citizens.
So knowing that now and understanding that part, that very complicated part of the history,
yeah,
I have to imagine that, you know, if you were to write Under the Apple Tree now, it might be somewhat different than the book you wrote in 85.
Well, I don't think it would be, because what I was trying to do and what I've always tried to do when I write books in a particular time is to present what was the feeling and issues of that era. And I've sometimes been confused that I'm trying to promote those issues, but I'm trying to reflect what it was. And I think most people in the city didn't know about this very good effort. And in fact, I think many people would have been upset by it. So it wasn't well publicized. But to school children, boys and girls, they would have had a very different picture, and they would have been bombarded by propaganda and all the songs. You know, there was a song, a popular song called "Goodbye, Mama, I'm Off to Yokohama for My Country and You, the Red, White, and Blue." So that was the predominant feeling of, and then there was a song called "Will Heil, Heil Right in Der Fuhrer's Face." So anything to make the enemy more than bad, more of a caricature, was part of that era.
Dan, let me ask you a bit about how this came to be that you have the book re-released now.
Well, Hawthorne Publishing, which is really Art and Nancy Baxter and Carmel, had read the book and thought that since this is the 70th anniversary of the end of the war, it would be appropriate to do a new edition. And it is a very beautiful new edition with a new preface by a writer who wrote a very good nonfiction book about the era called "Don't You Know There's a War On?" A man named Richard Lingerman, who, by the way, has written biographies of Dreiser and Sinclair Lewis. And I didn't know, I've known him for many years in New York, but I didn't know till recently he's from Crawfordsville. So the book has an all-Indiana writing cast.
Excellent, excellent. Well, it's great that it has this new edition out for people to be able to enjoy. Of course, many people have become more familiar with your work through recently the Vonnegut letters that you edited and Vonnegut speeches, as well as moving back to Indianapolis over the past couple of years and being part of our literary scene here.
Yes, and part of Indy Reed's books, which has been a great ally of me and many authors, and has been like a real pillar of support for writing and for writers here in the city.
Well, thank you for saying that. And thank you for coming into Art of the Matter today. It's great to have Under the Apple Tree available again for people to enjoy and read. And it really is just a terrific read. And pardon me if I pretend that the book is set in Indianapolis, even though I know it's not.
Yes, that's okay.
Thank you, Dan.
Thanks.
Travis DiNicola with author Dan Wakefield. Dan's book, Under the Apple Tree, was just re-released in a new edition published by Hawthorne Publishing. It's available at Indy Reads Books. You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio.
Those who have read writer Dan Carpenter's pleas for justice, equality, and fairness over the years in Indianapolis Star will readily recognize that same voice in Dan's newest book of poetry, The Art He'd Sell for Love. Sharon Gamble invited Dan to talk about how he discovered he was a writer, how poetry differs from prose, and how poems come to him.
So I'd like to ask you to start by reading the poem that I think of as the title poem. I don't know if you think of it that way or not. You're the author, but Art and Living.
Art and Living. I love your story, she says, but I'm wondering, the old couple, do they ever, like, get together? The answer's not in the story, he answers, college boy sage, but in the reader of it. As she smiles and nods, content to indulge him, he's in his own story, picturing his gifted hands raising her coat collar, brushing her cheek, wondering how cheap he'd sell this art, these words, scattered like seed at their feet.
So, have you ever thought of your writing as currency? Is it in fact, something by which you, something that you buy or sell for experience or for some kind of gain?
Fundamentally, I write, as I suppose most people do, to be noticed and to have my existence validated, and beyond that, maybe to really impress people. And there's no question, especially in the case of the younger persona of art and living, that you'd love to win somebody else's affections with it. So there's not much of a hang-up on my part as to the purity of art. And exactly what I'm trying to gain by it is often impossible to measure or to discriminate. But I don't kid myself that there's ego and there's some hope for gain beyond the art for art's sake.
Sure. Do you remember how you figured out, I assume fairly early in life, that there was power in words?
Definitely. And when I was in high school in particular, that's when I got the bug for journalism, because I found that, as just about the smallest and least fashionable and least athletic kid in my high school, I could, gain some fame and some status with little articles in school newspaper.
Hmm.
Not that many people could write well, just as not that many people could throw a spiral with a football.
Mm-hmm.
And so I latched onto that as as a way of, it's funny, not so much distinguishing myself from the crowd as being part of it.
Oh, you found that was your niche. That allowed you to fit in.
A little marginal place among the cool people. At least I could do that.
Did you go to school in Indianapolis?
Yes, St. Patrick's on the south side, mm-hmm. Fountain Square for grade school, and mm-hmm. then the old Cathedral High School, a few blocks from here.
All boys at the time.
All boys at the time.
Yeah, and pretty good size, so you had a lot of classmates.
Yeah, it was. It was maybe 700 or 800.
Yeah.
And, very good school. It was almost entirely staffed by the Holy Cross Brothers, and that's a phenomenon that's passed away.
Right.
Very strong academically and crazy about football.
Mm-hmm.
And we had I was, of course, from the near south side, and the elite guys, the cool guys, were mostly the north siders, and these are the ones we tried to keep up with and hope to get to sit next to at lunch.
Hmm. Did you have a mentor among the faculty or maybe an upperclassman who said, hey, dude, you can do this. Let me show you how.
Several of the English teachers. Brother Carl Schank, I remember, who was really feared for for the rigor of his classes, but I think took some pity on me and encouraged me about my writing. There was an algebra teacher named Brother John Aubrey, who was a Renaissance man.
Hmm.
Into classical music and all this sort of thing, and made mathematics comprehensible to me and even enjoyable. And
wish I'd had one of those.
Oh, really? Because he turned me into a B student in mathematics, and that was he may have gone to his grave not really. I was his greatest realizing it was his greatest achievement. Yeah, but some wonderful guys there, and that. Sort of teacher in that religious community it no longer exists.
Right. So it's one thing to discover that you have a talent for something. It's another thing to figure out where to apply that talent. And was there a moment where you said, well, this is clearly what I meant to study and to do for a living?
Probably by early college. I had settled on the default profession, I guess you'd call it, of newspapers. Because newspapers back then were major employers, and they were kind of printing money compared to the troubles that they're in now. Mm-hmm. I didn't see myself as a broadcast candidate, although I've always, I've always envied and pined about what you guys do.
Really? Why?
Yeah, I just think that dimension where you have the assembly of words and information and the voice and that immediacy and that drama, that life that it gives to words. I've always kind of had a yearning for that, but print media seemed to be, you know, the best fit for somebody who, you know, fairly shy and retiring and not gifted with a Robert Siegel voice, and was in my case, you know, I'd learned from newspapers and that authoritative and succinct and rhythmic style of writing, mm-hmm, really grabbed me.
And a newspaper is, not sure which tense, hopefully both tenses, a voice that helps shape a community that employs or contains the memory of a community.
Mm-hmm. There was that attraction to the feeling that you could have that kind of influence. And as I got more and more political, going to college in the 60s and working, as we've discussed this before, working in the black press right after college,
mm-hmm,
I became really zealous about righting wrongs and influencing policy.
Sure.
And then celebrating people who were really active in politics, active for social change at much greater risk than a writer is.
Right.
Just being able to hold them up.
Give them a voice.
Yeah.
So that's a very different way to use words than poetry, or is it?
Again, perhaps fundamentally not so much. I think one essential difference is the size of audience. Poetry can be very political. It can be an advocacy medium without losing its aesthetic integrity or whatever you want to call it. I mean, poets and critics debate that, whether the art form should be put to the service of anybody's political agenda. But poetry can do its job of beauty and also press for social change. But it's not going to reach that many people, and most of those that reaches are going to be members of the choir anyway. And this particular book is mostly personal reflections, and those tend to be pretty much apolitical, to the extent that, you know, Etheridge Knight used to say, you walk down the street and somebody says good morning, and how you answer is a political act. You can go to that extent.
Sure.
But newspaper work, advocacy journalism can be literature in itself, and is more free, mm-hmm, to push for changing the world in specific ways. Without figuring that it's compromised its aesthetic or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Would you read for us reading Rilke, Paying Respects, which is page 22, please?
Rilke's a favorite of mine, and I'm still trying to comprehend him. Mm-hmm. I gotta admit that he's out of my stratosphere. I should precede this one. I hate when poets do that. One of his more famous poems is the Archaic Torso of Apollo. Which ends with the line, "You must change your life." And this one is called Reading Rilke, Paying Respects. "I shall carry to my grave the art of dead dentists, men who displayed plastic skill as humbling to my own craft as their trade, alongside medicine or sculpture, was to them, in the eyes of those who dreaded their presence, yet rejoiced in their restoration of beauty, their banishment of pain. Gone now, one of them bereft for decades of the precision and stamina gifted him for gifting me, one a suicide, inexplicably, his playful little boast about that perfect crown as enduring to me as his handiwork. Gold and putty, rods and china, an Irish kid's ill-born mouth, outliving fate, merit, the makers of miracles, and one day the host himself, monument and brother to the dead, who will leave a piecemeal Apollo that changed his life."
A good many of the poems in this book seem valedictory to me, as though you're starting to settle some accounts.
Yeah, maybe that's maybe another word for that is senescence. I don't know. I did find myself. I chose from this scads of poems I've accumulated over the years for this fairly small number, and they did seem to keep coming back to a kind of a closing testament, or as you say, valediction. And I notice also there's not a lot of cheerfulness in most of them.
Did that surprise you after you said this one, here's the book?
Yeah, and maybe it comes down to catharsis. I did find that depending on what mood I was in when I was pulling things together, I did from time to time come up with pieces that were a little more sportif or playful.
Yeah, your tribute to Paul Simon is very playful.
Well, that one, yeah, that one was a lot of fun. and maybe it's significant that the poem is made up almost entirely of stolen lines from somebody else, you know? I should make that a habit. I should be the weird Al Yankovic of poetry.
Sharon Gamble with writer Dan Carpenter. Dan's new book of poems is called The Art He'd Sell for Love, and it's available on Amazon. You can also read Dan's work at indianaforefront.com. That's indianaforefront.com, thestatehousefile.com, and skybluewindow.org.
Hey, Travis?
Yes, Sharon?
We just have enough time on our calendar to say
Happy New Year!
And don't forget, you can learn more about local arts events at indiearts.org/guide, the Arts Council of Indianapolis's Indie Arts Guide.
That's right, and we will be back next year with lots and lots of things to do in January, because, of course, there will be on that calendar that we call
What Do We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
Historical fiction author James Alexander Thom's new novel, Fire in the Water, is based on the tragic explosion of the paddle wheel steamboat Sultana near Memphis in the last days of the Civil War. Travis DiNicola spoke with Thom about the work.
James Alexander Thom, welcome back to Art of the Matter. It's great to have you in our studio again.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
You are very welcome, and congratulations on the new book, Fire in the Water, which we're going to be talking about. This is actually a sequel. I mean, I know it stands alone, but it's a sequel to a book that you'd written before.
It has the same protagonist who was a army camp errand boy in the Mexican War during the 1840s. But by this book, he's grown up to become a war correspondent for Harper's Magazine.
Okay. But in St. Patrick's Battalion, he lost a hand, did he not? Is that right?
Yes, he lost his left hand at the Battle of Buena Vista. And so he's famous for not just being a war correspondent, but being the famous one-armed war correspondent.
Okay. And in this book, so as a war correspondent, this historical fiction is really centered around the story of an incredible maritime disaster that I honestly did not know a whole lot about, which is the sinking of the riverboat Sultana on the Mississippi. Let's start with the basic history of that, and then we'll talk more about the novel itself.
Well, there's actually that's the central action theme, but there's so much more to it than that. You know, the book starts off when they learn down in New Orleans that Lincoln's been assassinated.
Mm-hmm.
And in the meantime, you know, Lee has already surrendered to Grant, and the war's still going on in the East. But the country is looking for John Wilkes Booth.
Mm-hmm.
The country is looking for Jefferson Davis, who's running all over the South trying to get away. So there are an awful lot of things going on. And even though this explosion of the steamboat took a bigger death toll than even the Titanic, not a lot of people ever heard about it because it was pretty small news compared with what else was going on.
Hmm.
For the one thing, the end of the Civil War, you know.
Sure, yeah.
So
a lot of big things go, and the death of Abraham Lincoln. And
But the real tragic part of this Sultana thing is that almost all the people on that boat had survived a bunch of battles in the Civil War,
mm-hmm.
and then they had survived months and months, maybe a year, in Andersonville Prison, which was just a terrible, terrible place. And the only thing that was keeping them alive was the idea that they were going home.
So, yeah.
So this must have been about the unluckiest bunch of soldiers in the whole Civil War.
Andersonville Prison. Tell me a bit more about this. It was a prison that the Confederates run for Union soldiers, and you had a distant relative who was there. Is that right?
My great-grandfather, Robert C. Thom, was a prisoner there. He was released, you know, as Sherman came through the South. The Southerners were enough in dread of him that they didn't want him finding that camp because they knew he'd be madder than he was.
Yeah.
And when they found it, of course, he was. But anyway, so my great-grandfather was released before the group that went onto the steamboat.
Okay.
So he was not on that steamboat.
But pretty horrific conditions.
Pardon?
Pretty horrific conditions at this prison, it sounds like.
About 100 people died a day there. It was there were about 18 acres, no shelter except what the soldiers could rig up. Virtually no food because the Confederates could hardly even feed their own army, let alone 32,000 prisoners of war
wow.
in one camp. Now, that's 32,000 people and 18 acres.
Yeah.
It was
pretty
just like
tight
a pigsty, you know.
Wow, jeez.
Somehow my ancestor did survive that and went on to live a long, productive life. But the conditions of it were described. The first time I ran across it was in a book called Andersonville by McKinley Cantor, way back in the 40s, I think it was. And I thought, it's hard to believe that such a place existed.
Hmm.
Of course, we had a big prison camp up here, too, you know, for the Southerners, for the rebels. It's where Crown Hill Cemetery is now. And it wasn't a real nice place, but it wasn't that bad. At least they could feed them, you know. So
these were some unlucky soldiers to be in this prison, and then once they are released to be on this riverboat that it blew up. How did that happen? How did this?
Well, there's a lot of some technical stuff concerning the kind of boiler they were using.
Okay.
It was a kind of boiler that circulated water through the fire instead of just over it, like a tea kettle, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But the circulation pipes could get clogged up with mud from the Mississippi and so forth. And they believe that's what happened, was that, and that would create hot spots, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But the boat had already stopped at Vicksburg to have the boiler patched because it was leaking and hissing, one of the boilers. And it was while they were stopped there getting that boiler fixed that the prisoners from that camp there, the prisoner exchange camp, were sent down to get on the boat. And the boat was only supposed to carry 375 people.
Hmm.
In addition to the people that were already on it, they put on 2,000 of these sick, wretched soldiers.
It still had to be an enormous boat, though.
It was 260 feet long by 60 feet long.
So they
wide.
Were really yeah. just packed in there.
And they were just, they couldn't, they were even on the roof,
yeah.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
The packing, the population on that boat was so thick that the captain himself, at a point or two, had to crawl along a railing because he couldn't climb up the stairs. The stairs were full of people, you know. But they were getting $5 a head for shipping these people home, and so they just, greed took over. And as it happened, the boiler didn't hold because they were steaming too fast. The river was at flood stage.
Mm-hmm.
The river was about 3 miles wide with flooding. So it was a perfect storm of bad circumstances.
Wow.
When it blew up. Now, the main character, Paddy Quinn, this mm-hmm. War correspondent, the reason he's going up on that boat is because he's going up to cover Abraham Lincoln's funeral in Springfield, Illinois.
So he's riding the boat to get up there.
He's taking the boat up to get up there. He's on there with his bride. He's just gotten married.
Hmm.
And when the boat starts loading up with all these prisoners from Andersonville, he realizes he's got another good scoop here because people are very interested in what was going on down there. So
mm-hmm.
he knows that if he starts interviewing all these people, he's got another story that adds a dimension to his funeral story. And, of course, before it's over with, he's got still another aspect of the story, which is surviving the tragedy.
To be able to tell the tale.
Yeah, so by the time he gets to Springfield, I don't want to give a end
mm-hmm,
away,
sure.
but by the time he gets there, he's got three big stories and so much information that he hardly knows where to start. You
yeah.
know? So,
yeah. If you just tuned in, this is Travis DiNicola on Art of the Matter with James Alexander Thom, and we're talking about the book that recently has been published, his book, Fire in the Water. And it just sounds like a great read for, of course, anyone interested in history, Civil War history. In some ways, it's also an adventure book. I know you do very careful research in your work. As you've been working on this, what were some interesting things that you came across that you included in the book or were just maybe surprising to you?
Well, one of the first surprises was that New Orleans, even though it was occupied by the Federals at that point, didn't learn about the assassination until about 4 or 5 days later because the Secretary of War had said, don't telegraph this assassination to the South because they will fight harder because Lincoln was going to give them a very lenient peace terms.
Mm-hmm.
And his vice president, Johnson, thought that all the Southern generals should be tried as traitors.
Mm-hmm.
So they were more likely to keep resisting if they knew that Lincoln had been killed. So that was a surprise to me. That it astonished Patty Quinn because he had gotten married. He thought he would see Lincoln again someday. He'd met him before.
Mm-hmm.
He thought he'd see him again someday, and then he found out that on the day of his wedding, Lincoln had already been assassinated.
And
so he didn't know that.
It's interesting to consider the delay of news as a tactic within warfare. But, you know, of course, at that time, it's something that probably couldn't quite exist in the same way now. But as you were saying, even the story of this riverboat exploding and going down didn't make the news a lot because it was overshadowed by the assassination and other things happening at the end of the war.
Yeah, it made the newspapers in the vicinity. It did make Harper's Magazine, but it made all the... See, the Associated Press was already in operation then.
Mm-hmm.
And so everybody heard about it, but it just did not have legs because they were interested in all these other things that were going on.
Sure, sure.
Uh-huh. And anyway, Patty Quinn is a character that I liked so much after creating him for the first book, and I had the joy of... He was learning to write and finding out that he could really be somebody if he could express things for himself and for other people. So he becomes a correspondent, and that puts him right in the middle of all this stuff in a very logical way. It also gives me a chance to explain how they, the Civil War was famous for the photography, you know, Matthew Brady and all those other people.
Of course.
But the cameras were so slow then that the only way you could illustrate battle scenes was have somebody draw them. And so Patty is, as many of the correspondents were, he's both a writer and a sketch artist, battlefield sketch artist. So he draws pictures of everything, and I do the pictures for him. But he draws pictures of everything that's pertinent to this story, and then they will be etched and printed in New York, you know, by the magazine.
So which came first for you on this, the desire to write another story with Patty or the desire to write the story about the Sultana?
It sort of all came together, I guess. One thing was that my wife and I, for about 10 years or so, we were history lecturers on the Delta Queen line. And I had grown up on Mark Twain and his life on the Mississippi and all that, so I've always had river boating in my blood. And this was an opportunity to tell a story which is, it's not just the story itself, but it's a vehicle for a more underlying message, which is coming out of a conflict and how it's always so costly even to end something, you know. And but between my ancestor and my love for the new character, Patty Quinn, and my love for the steamboats, why, it was just a perfect opportunity to tell another. my most best-known book was Follow the River, and I was telling my wife the other day, you know, just about every book I ever wrote could be called Follow the River. Because that's the way everybody traveled then, you know. Another thing that's interesting, of course, was that by the end of the Civil War, the railroads were taking dominance over the steamboat travel. So there's there's a little bit of that in there, too. There's there's some railroad travel from St. Louis up to Springfield and how that had to be done, you know. And of course, I've always been a railroad nut, too, because my grandfather was a New York Central engineer. So it's just there are so many big, wonderful things in the history of this country that if I lived another 100 years, I couldn't use it up, you know. There's no problem getting ideas. Mm-hmm. The problem is living long enough to write them all.
Well, James Alexander, so I want to thank you for coming in today and talking about Fire in the Water, your most recent book. Looking forward to reading it very much. It just sounds like a great history and great adventure story, and always a pleasure to chat with you.
Thank you for letting me talk about some of my favorite things.
Travis DiNicola with author James Alexander Thom. His latest historical novel is Fire in the Water, and it's available at bookstores everywhere.
Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Bocelli Wallrap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m., when I'll learn about a very early bicentennial concert.
Very cool.
Yeah.
We'll revisit my conversation with Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra's maestro Christoph Urbanski about the cosmos and music.
Awesome. And I'll get a preview of Skylight, a theater on the square. And we'll have that arts calendar we call
What Do We Do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.